Good day, everyone. Welcome to the Bringing Inspiration to Earth show. To find out more about our upcoming shows or access to our more than 1,800 podcast episodes, visit our website at www.biteradio.me. Today, my special guest is Thomas Mullaney, author of How We Disappear, A Personal History of Information. In the public imagination, we're living in an era of permanent memory. Everything is stored, searchable, and retrievable, especially now as AI systems ingest vast archives of human speech, images, and text. Yet, How We Disappear, A Personal History of Information, by Stanford Professor of History Thomas Mullaney, tells a more unsettling truth. Information doesn't naturally endure. It breaks down, scatters, becomes unaffordable to recover, and far more often than we admit, simply vanishes. Thomas Mullaney is a professor of history, East Asian languages and cultures at Stanford University, a Guggenheim Fellow and former CLUES Chair in Technology and Society at the Library of Congress. He is the award-winning author of The Chinese Typewriter, which was winner of the John K. Fairbank Prize, and other books on the global history of technology and information. For more information, you can visit his website, which is tsmullaney.com. That's tsmullaney.com. And with that, I'd like to welcome Tom to the show. Good day, sir.
A very good day to you, too.
Great. So I always, since my show is about inspiration, I always kind of like to find out from authors, what inspired you to write this book at this particular time?
So when I talk with my students at Stanford, we often talk about the pebble in your shoe or some kind of splinter, some kind of point of friction where you're walking around in your life and there's something that you just constantly notice. I don't just mean when you're at your job, but just when you're walking your dog or going to get the mail, and that's probably your best guide for what you should be working on and what you should be writing on. And for me, probably, I guess it's about 25 years ago, I just really started to notice the scattered junk on the sides of highways as I drove along, or the photographs in albums in my bookshelf, you know, whose the names of the individuals, I just had no idea who they were, being in thrift shops and finding old yearbooks and old wedding albums and thinking, you know, who are these individuals and how does this end up in a thrift store in Brooklyn? And I suppose I just became worried in some sense about the everyday ways that things disappear, that they kind of fall out of memory, fall out of the stories we tell, and specifically those that aren't dramatic in their exit. Not censorship or book burnings or cataclysm or natural disaster, but the more day-to-day ways that things disappear. And that's gnawed at me for a very, very, very long time. But it wasn't until my father died and I was moving through, you know, working through all of his materials that concern really came home. And that was, I guess, the more proximate birth of the book was the passing of my father.
Yeah. It's interesting that, well, first of all, my neighbor, a couple doors down, his mom just passed. And some of the things you talk about in your book, you know, as you were working through your father's room and stuff left behind, you know, just reminded me of some of the things that he's going through right now. And I think we all go through that, you know, at that point when there's a death, you know, particularly of a parent, you know, that we have to, you know, kind of put into context their role and all of the information that they gave us throughout the years.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's that's a good word for it, role. So one thing I talk about in the book is, just as a byproduct of my childhood, is just the way that my family was when I was born, and I really never knew or saw either my father or my mother in any other context. So they had, you know, my mom had siblings, but they were estranged, so I never really saw my mom playing the role of sister, and I never knew my grandparents on her side, so I never really saw her as a daughter. And then with my father, he was an only child. He had cousins, but he too was kind of estranged from his family in another sense. So the only way I ever knew these two individuals was 100% exclusively as mom and dad, this one role. And when going through, after my father's death and then after my mother's death, which I talk about in the book, is trying to recover those lost dimensions of their lives, to try to understand them as human beings rather than just, you know, just these roles. And that's I think where it really drove home just how hard it is to recover those missing dimensions, that those are the things that are disappearing.
Yeah, and so many times we don't have the knowledge or just the references to be able to put things into context. Like, for example, you mentioned photographs, going through, and some photographs may not have been marked. So you may not know the individual. You may not know where it was or when it was. And there's so many bits of information that can usually be, I mean, if it were noted on the back of a photo, then that's great. But more often than not, that's not the case.
That's right. Yeah, and that's you've hit it on the head. That's basically one of the core arguments of the book. It's less of an argument than simply pointing out what something that I think that many of us instinctively know, but we tend not to think about. Which is, I'll just give you an example. Like, as I sit here talking with you right now, I'm in my oldest son's room. He's at school. It's a nice quiet spot to sit and have this conversation. And the wall is covered with photographs, him and his brother, him with his nonna, his grandma from Italy, with me, with my wife. There is not a single photograph that is labeled. And that makes perfect sense, because the first thing that every human being, our first job, basically, to be alive, is to cobble together our life here and now. We human beings pay almost no attention to posterity, the idea that I should live my life in a way such that after I'm gone, I'm easy to reconstruct, because why in the world would anyone live their life in that way? And so these photographs are doing their job, in the sense that I don't need any help to know that this picture I'm looking at is a picture of me and my son. And I don't need any additional information to know this other little photograph I'm looking at is, you know, my children and my wife. The situation of our life itself gives me all the information I need for these pictures to be meaningful and for them to like fit in. But, and this is that moment, if you, for me in my father's bedroom after his death, or like I mentioned, being in a thrift store in Brooklyn and finding a wedding album from the turn of the century, is the moment that life becomes history. You become acutely aware of all of those missing links. And, you know, if we fast forward 200 years into the future, and for some reason these photographs that I'm looking at right now still exist, there's not going to be anyone who could ever put them back into their, or it'd be exceedingly difficult, if not impossible, to put them back into their original context. And that you know, I'm an historian. That's what I do all, you know, 9 to 5, Monday through Friday.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess the book was me as an historian trying to face up to why it is so hard to reconstruct the past. And, you know, it is a somewhat of a disconcerting truth, but that's no reason to look away from it.
Yeah, that's true. Now, I believe in the book you mentioned, you're talking about photographs and mentioning that just the idea of documenting on the back of a photo as much information as possible, who it was, where it was, all that kind of thing, can sometimes seem, I guess, morbid in a way. And the fact that you're kind of looking to a future where all of that information may be necessary to put it into perspective.
Yes, there's a morbidness to it. There's an ache. There's an ache to that process because, you're imagining a world in which, and especially if it's family photographs, in some sense, you're engaged in an activity where you are imagining one or more of these people you love above all else, including yourself, are gone. And it's an incredibly valuable act. It is a very, very generous act because you're taking up your time so that perhaps family members and next of kin you will never meet in your life have the ability to kind of keep the story unbroken, so to speak. But for you, every hour, technically speaking, that you spend in front of your photo album labeling those photos is 1 hour that you are not spending with those same exact human beings. They're over on the couch watching TV. So it's a trade-off. That's like basically, again, one of the core observations of the book is you can live for life, and you can live for posterity, but it's very rare when you are doing this, you can do the same at the same time, do both at the same time. And we tend to choose life over posterity for totally understandable reasons.
I agree. Now, in the book, talk about when entering your father's room and then just that your archivist training about original order kicked in. And I found that interesting. I had no idea what original order was. So can you explain it to the listeners what it is and how it fits into the idea of that general understanding of context?
Sure. Original order is a concept that archivists use and historians use. And in a nutshell, it's you want to keep things to the best of your ability in the order that you found it. And so probably for a listener, something they will have heard before is, crime scene investigation or imagine an archaeological dig. So if you're an FBI agent on the scene of a crime, and you arrive and there's a gun case, there's a shell casing over here, there's a footprint over here, there's a, heaven forbid, there's a body over here. It's not just the stuff that is informative. It's not just the stuff, the objects, that are the information of that crime scene. It's actually, kind of like the constellation of all of those objects, the location of those objects in relationship to each other. And the same thing when someone, a trained archaeologist, not like an Indiana Jones grave robber type, but like a trained archaeologist is excavating a site, the reason that they move so deliberately and slowly is not just so that they don't damage the shard of pottery or whatever, but also so that they can steadily document where everything was in relationship to each other. Now, eventually, you're going to take those shell casings and put them in plastic bags, or you're going to take those shards of pottery and move them to a research facility or a museum, but not before you kept meticulous notes about where everything was in the beginning. And the reason you do that is it's actually that arrangement of stuff which more often than not tells you the truth of the situation. It's, the shell casing is over here, the footprint is over there, the body is over there. Therefore, we have reason to believe that the shooter was over here, that they ran over there afterwards. That's what allows you to reconstruct the past. If you just went into the crime scene gathered up all the shell casings, trampled all over the fingerprints, and, you know, moved the body around, you could still have all of the stuff of the crime scene, but you will have permanently and irrevocably destroyed any chance of reconstructing what happened. That's the same principle as original order. So if I go into, well, you know, when I went into my father's room, and part of my mind is this mixture of just utter sadness and grief, but also this lifelong sense in the back of my mind that I never really understood this guy. I never really understood my father as a three-dimensional human being living his life on planet Earth. He's always just been dad to me. And if I walk into his room and start just moving things around, that I might accidentally ruin any chance that I had of perhaps having some insight about him. Now, that doesn't mean that you preserve everywhere, like, oh, this is Abraham Lincoln's bedroom, and this way we kept the chair and the exact, no one can afford to do that in their life. You can't actually preserve things in their perfect original order, but you have to try to document what that looked like. And so then, you know, in the book, I talk about making a map of the room so that if and when I found something, I would remember where my father put it, where he kept it. Because it, you know, if your father keeps a photograph, you know, a wedding photograph, and that wedding photograph is on the bedside table, that's not the same thing as a wedding photograph in a box under a mattress. That's not the exact same thing. And so that's the basic idea of original order.
Yeah. And when, you know, you actually kind of went in and started to sort through his things, and you mentioned grief, how does, you know, grief affect memory, you know, and information that we receive?
The way, for me, just speaking myself, I think grief has, it's a double-edged sword. One, it heightens my senses and kind of puts me on alert. I tend to become quite observant, and almost the filters come down, and kind of more makes it, you're kind of more vulnerable. And so a lot more stuff sort of enters into your eyes and your ears. On the other side, and I think this is probably true when I was at the emergency room, and, you know, when he actually died, then I think it probably veers closer to the realm of trauma, where one of the defining features of it is you don't remember, or I don't know the cognitive science of it or the neuroscience, but, you know, short-term memories do not become long-term memories. And so that, I will admit, has already begun to cloud over. It is disappearing, and started disappearing from the moment it happened. So it was definitely a mixture over the course of those first few days.
Yeah. So now the idea of us disappearing. Can you talk a little bit about the, you know, I understood your book, you indicated that it's not about how we die, but about how we disappear. So can you explain a little bit more about just the idea of disappearing? You know, most of us really hope, you know, that we won't disappear, you know, in the sense of, you know, after our passing, but that's what happens.
I want to just be very honest and transparent. You know, if anyone who's listening does read the book, they'll see this, I hope, come through in the book, is I'm as terrified of it as I always have been. I think it's actually, I'm not over it. I have not achieved nirvana or some indifference to this. It hits me, even after writing this book as hard as it did before, of not wanting to disappear, of having some sort of you know, being remembered or something of that nature. And actually, I would say in the book that the argument is there is something about being alive, being a human being, that in fact requires us to be terrified of it, requires us to, in a sense, not be too at peace with it, even though it is an unassailable truth. So, you know, let's just take two pieces of the puzzle. Each chapter of the book is named after, you know, one facet of how we disappear. But to take two of them, one is that the physical traces of our lives, photographs from prom or, you know, diaries or letters, you know, to and from the war, or that the physical medium of everything as we speak is degrading. So paper, it doesn't, you know, it's sort of like watching grass grow. It happens, or paint dry. It happens too slow to see it. But as we speak, every single piece of paper that is surrounding me in my son's room is drying and cracking. All of the color on all of the photographs are kind of sapping out or bleaching slowly. And then at a larger frame still, you know, we have some store-bought picture frames. They're probably, the wood of those is probably impregnated with all sorts of chemicals. Those chemicals, as we speak, are slowly not just leaching out, but quite literally eating at a chemical level the very photograph that we bought it to frame. And so at one level, there is just the basic fact of the matter that the stuff in which so much of the memories of our lives are encoded are themselves degrading. And you brought up computers in the digital age. File formats go obsolete. I mean, right now, it's hard to imagine a world in which there is no such thing as a PDF anymore, or a JPEG, or a MP3. But those, you know, there are countless graveyards of file formats from not long ago that we could list, and it is a certainty that these file formats and everything encoded in them, you know, follows this sort of pathway. So at one level, it's just literally all the places where the traces of our lives are inscribed or encoded or magnetically, you know, embedded, are just degrading at various speeds. But that's actually just one piece of the puzzle, because that's, for example, stuff that we did record in our lives, and then what happens to the trace of that. If we back up the tape, however, the vast majority of our lives, like the overwhelming pie slice of our lives, are not leaving any trace whatsoever. I quote Darwin in the book. So Darwin in the 19th century is talking about like the fossil record and the record of human life that he needed to study in order to build the theory of evolution. And he has this one amazing quote, and he says, "You look at the richest geological museums and their richest collections by the wealthiest institutions, and what a paltry display you find." And what he meant by that is, you know, soft-celled organisms do not enter the fossil record, that, you know, vast portions of life on this planet really effectively leave no lasting trace whatsoever. And so there is another part of disappearance, which is not a story of pictures fading or paper yellowing. It's of no trace ever having been made in the first place. And so there's, you know, through the book, I go into different facets of this gemstone of disappearance, and I try to pretty patiently but pretty briskly kind of offer a guided tour for the reader through this aspect, that aspect of how it is that we disappear.
Yeah. Now, one of the things that I noticed is that you indicated, I believe, that the disappearance of memory much of a family's history is lost, you know, within just a generation or two. I mean, it's mm-hmm. not very long. So can you talk about, I mean, to me, it just seems like in the scheme of things, it seems to be a very short period of time to lose, you know, such basic information that kind of ties one back to their history, familial history.
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, I do think there have been a number of studies, and writing this book really brought me into contact with just so many brilliant and fascinating scholars and artists and practitioners who I learned, you know, so much about, because I myself am not a cognitive scientist. I'm not a neuroscientist. I'm not a cell biologist so I really owe an immense debt of gratitude to experts who are willing to, you know, open up and share with me. But one comes to mind, which is there have been studies of newspapers and studies of textbooks and history books and so forth to say over time what happens to, let's call it, the specificity of different dates that are mentioned. So, let's, you know, if you were to pick up a history book, or if you pick up a newspaper article, and it's talking about, I don't know, inflation, or it's talking about the war in Iran, or it's talking about the Supreme Court, whatever it's talking about, it would be very, very, very common to see really specific dates to be mentioned, so that in 1971 there's this important precedent to what's happening, or in 1987 this happened, or 1939 this happened. But when you're standing in, say, the year 2026, quite literally, as the dates get further and further away from us, first of all, the number of references to dates declines precipitously. It's just mm-hmm. there are fewer times in a newspaper that you will see mention of the 1400s or the 1700s mm-hmm. or the 1200s than the 1900s. So one is that there's just this vast drop-off in just how often we talk about the past beyond a certain point. But what's also interesting is that numbers start to get like rounded. So people will say, instead of saying 1917 something happened, it'll be in the 1400s or around 1450, or things just get chunkier, let's call it. And then eventually there are just whole swaths of human history that basically never get mentioned again. And you can see this play out at the family level too. You know, so mothers and fathers, uncles and aunts, brothers and sisters, that's like 1919, 1937, 1989. That you expect to come up a lot. Then you start getting to the realm of grandparents and great-grandparents, and suddenly references start to drop off, but also things get more vague. Mm-hmm. The number of people, I don't know in your life, but just thinking of my own, the number of people in which great-grandparents, let alone great-great-grandparents or great-great-great, are in any way an active part of daily conversation and with any specificity, it's like it just falls off a cliff. And so there is this element in which, and again, I do this as much as any other person. Human beings are here and now organisms. We've got so much to do to keep our lives in order and just get through the day and, you know, get Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, that we naturally prioritize stuff that is, for lack of a better word, relevant to the here and now. And we are more willing than I think we're willing to admit. We do this more than we're willing to admit, is we let that stuff fall away. We let it fall away because it has nothing to do with our commute to work. It has nothing to do with making lunch for your kid on the way to school. It's optional. It's secondary. And so if we that's, you know, in the book, I try to talk about this and say, I would say we'd like to imagine ourselves as living in a huge continuity of time, but the more honest truth is that we're more or less living in a pretty tiny bubble, a pretty tiny envelope of time, and the rest of it is largely storytelling. It's largely stories we tell ourselves. So we're looking through a keyhole most of the time.
Yeah, it seems that, you know, it kind of goes back to that, you know, idea of living for life or posterity, you know, the living of life, you know, things that are very much in the here and now that need to, you know, attention to be paid to them in order to exist. So now, I believe you indicate too that the idea of the internet never forgets is largely a myth. So I'd be curious to find out your view of that.
Sure. So I think many listeners will already know this, but you know the reason that historians, the reason what we call the Dark Ages, is not because they were especially violent or dismal times. We call the Dark Ages the same reason that we call dark matter dark matter. It's that it's less is known about it. So in this case, the darkness is our understanding or even ability to understand it. There are people way smarter than me who built the internet, Vint Cerf included, who say that there is reason to believe we're living in a dark age right now, meaning that in 100, 200, 500 years, that we will be one of the most unknowable periods of time in human history. And why, you know, why is that? And and the simple reason is that, two simple reasons is so much of the stuff that we are producing in our day-to-day life, the stuff that future historians would want to be able to get their hands on to understand us, are living inside of Gmail and Slack channels and, soon-to-be dead websites and et cetera. So a lot of them are literally in like proprietary databases or behind firewalls or inside the servers of companies that at some point, you know, will go out of business, will go away, Google included, will go away. They're not living inside of letters that we wrote to our love that are sitting in a bedside table somewhere. They are not, you know, photographs in an album that, yes, like I said before, that those photos are yellowing and the paper is drying out, but actually that process in many ways is slower and more stable than how digital things fall apart. And then all of it, the iPhone photos you have and all of the audio files I have and all of the PDFs and all of the, they are all inside of file formats, inside of computer applications that actually exhibit very rapid speeds of degradation. Magnetic media are one of the most unstable forms of recording that human beings have ever created. And so if I were to, you know, when I went into my father's room and when I began with my brother to go through my mother's belongings after her death, if we find a box of letters from 60 years ago, well, we find my mother and father's letters when he was, stationed in Japan during the Vietnam War, and we can read those letters. If we had found those as a box of floppy disks, or even CD-ROM drives, they would have become unreadable. Now, I could, if I were the CIA or the, you know, if I were an, I could pay $1 million and reconstruct that data. But you know, the average person is not the CIA, and so there's reason to believe that this moment when we feel is. So, information is at our fingertips, no matter which way we look, will, in hindsight, be one of the most difficult periods of human history to reconstruct.
Yeah. Now, there was one bit of information in your book, an example that for me really highlighted the importance of information and how, you know, the disappearance of some information can be vital. And that was in your Stanford History of Information class, mm-hmm. you give students an assignment to select and prepare a dish from a 19th century cookbook. So, yeah. So would you mind explaining, first of all, the purpose of the assignment, how it unfolded, and what the students learned from that assignment?
I'm so glad. Thank you for bringing that up. Yeah, that's like one of my favorite experiences in life, and was also very fun to write about in the book. So I teach this course on, you know, the history of technology, the history of information technology. So we talk about, you know, the history of the book and of movable type printing and all the way up to the internet and personal computing, et cetera. And one of the really difficult to explain parts of information is actually that earlier idea of original order, the idea that there is so much information encoded not in things themselves, but in kind of the constellation of things, the arrangement of things. But also there's information encoded in families, there's information encoded in literally the tools we use to get things done. And so you can talk at someone until you're blue in the face and try to explain this principle, but often it's met with kind of like, yeah, I got it, but never quite sure that the person actually got it. So I decided to make it an activity. So you're right. I give them a recipe from a cookbook from the 19th century, and in theory, the recipe has everything the person needs to successfully produce that recipe. It could be like an apple tart or some kind of baked good. There's various choices. But you know, we have the ingredient list, we have instructions, so it should be very, very straightforward. And then what they discover immediately is, oh my gosh, I don't have everything I need. They'll discover that the recipe does not mention what temperature to cook it at, that the recipe does not give a time or a duration, just says things like cook until done, will mention ingredients whose names they don't recognize in the 21st century. And just one thing after the next that is getting in the way of them producing what is actually quite really basic recipes. Again, things like apple tarts here. We're not talking about, I don't know, baked Alaska or something. And so the conversation then is, well, someone in that time was able to use this recipe to successfully make these things. But you're telling me that not all the information that is needed is in this recipe. So then the question becomes, where is that missing information? And it's really, really fun, because I'll just give you one example, which is, well, you know, okay, let's talk about temperature. Yes, it doesn't include a temperature in this recipe, but that doesn't mean that stoves in the 1860s, just by virtue of the way, you know, their shape and their size and the metal that they were made out of and how, you know, where the wood went and how close the grill was to where the heat source would be, that doesn't mean that stoves didn't tend towards a particular temperature that basically everyone in common sense would have understood. In the same way that when, you know, if you're good at barbecuing outside, there's no, at least on the classic grills, there's no temperature gauge. But if you know your way around a grill, you kind of have a sixth sense about how hot it is and when you can put the burgers down and so forth. Well, they had that in the 1860s, someone who could cook this had that sixth sense about how hot the grill is. But now that common sense is gone. family members may have leaned over and said, you know, what do you think? Is this done? And, you know, the grandpa or grandma, whoever the cook in the family was, could have said to the newbie, let's say, no, you got to leave it in for a few more minutes. You got to wait until you see some color on that dough. You know, you got to wait till you see that. And so there's another example of information that is transmitted generationally, and it becomes, again, part of, let's call it common sense. Well, the funny thing about common sense is it's so common that we don't write it down. Because why in the world would I write it down? It's like the water, you know, it's like the water I swim in as a fish. I'm not going to write down the water. The water is just here and taken for granted until it's not. And that's that whole idea of most things in existence, the first phase of disappearance is not actually the destruction of the stuff itself. It is the loss of, for lack of a better word, the common sense in which it lived. Mm. It's the stuff that no one ever even thought to record or write down because it's so obvious, so second nature. And then the students, you know, they've come to class, they brought their Tupperware with all of this, these largely inedible things, but they really got it. Like I've done that exercise dozens of times because it's basically like instant enlightenment for the student of history about what it is that we're actually trying to reconstruct when we try to reconstruct history, and also why it's so hard to do.
Yeah. Well, it really was for me. You know, it was one of those things that just stood out. Like, now I get it. Now I get it. So, well, guys, we're already toward the end of the show here, Tom. So what do you hope that the readers are going to take away from reading How We Disappear?
I hope that, you know, our conversation doesn't give off the wrong impression of the book as depressing or in any way despondent. It's not about lamenting and wailing and crying about this fact of existence. In fact, I do hope that for those who pick up the book and read it, we'll discover that it's actually quite optimistic. I really mean it when I say, I talk about this in the book, that the universe has been falling apart since the moment of its inception. You know, heat death, the second law of thermodynamics, entropy has been around and was around for billions and billions of years before life formed in the universe. And what that means is that life, there is something miraculous about the existence of life, because life is the most improbable thing one could imagine. Life, it's the defining feature of life, including human life, is this high wire act in the face of entropy. And so when I say that, you know, most people live for living, they live for the here and now, and history is sort of an afterthought, that's not me criticizing us as human beings. It's actually in admiration and appreciation for what a miracle it is that we get through the day, that we get from Monday to Tuesday and Tuesday to Wednesday, like just cobbling together a life inside a universe that is falling apart is already a miracle. And so I, as the historian, I will cut myself some slack. The historian Tom Mullaney cuts just person Tom Mullaney from some slack. In the fact that when I go and try to do my job as the historian, so many things are so difficult to reconstruct. And one of the reasons is that every human being is living for now. It's actually, the book ends with a kind of awe and wonder at the fact that we're able to do that in the first place. So it comes out as not in any way, I hope the reader, you know, readers who pick it up will see, actually quite optimistic by the end of the work. And I hope some people will pick up the book and hope that they get something out of it.
Yeah, I didn't get that depressing kind of feeling, you know, from reading it. I really did get the more optimistic and, you know, recognizing that, you know, basically everything is going to disappear, you know, at one time or another, kind of takes the weight off of trying to have to, you know, preserve things for the future.
I'm very, very glad to hear you say that, because, you know, when you spend so long time writing a book, you can't see it anymore.
Well, you did good there. So thank you for your time today. I really appreciate it. It's really been informative, and I know I will never look at information again the same way as I have before reading the book.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome. Again, everyone, today my special guest has been Thomas Mullaney, author of How We Disappear, A Personal History of Information. And again, you can find out more by visiting his website, which is tsmullaney.com, and that's tsmullaney.com. And just to remember that the release date for the book is June 23rd, but it is also available for pre-order on Amazon now. And everyone, I want to thank you for joining us for this edition of the Bringing Inspiration to Earth Show. And remember to be a bright light by bringing inspiration to your world and to the lives of those you touch.